Okay, so this Sunday, the key scripture is John 5, 1 through 9, so we'll start by reading that together. That's John chapter 5, verses 1 through 9. The pause is so you can look it up, right? You get that? Yep. So, verse 1. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. Now there is in Jerusalem near the Sheep Gate a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One who had been there as an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me get into the pool when the water is stirred. While I am trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." Then Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat and walk." At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. The glory of God. What a beautiful story. Yeah, come on. You want to give God a cheer for that. Amazing story, and considered by many to be the third sign in John. Hope there's not too much of a distraction, but I want to put up an image from Dura Europos. That was a Hellenistic, Parthian, and Roman border city built on the escarpment above the Euphrates River in present-day Syria. So this is a Christian home church. In other words, it was a home that was converted into a church around 230 AD, so pretty early on. And here we have a very Roman Jesus with short hair and toga instructing the man to get up and pick up his bed, which is a full-framed bed with some sort of latticed sort of thing like that. I don't think that's what the original situation was like. But it's very interesting how we love to, you know, make things in our, the way we're comfortable with them. Most likely the bed was made of palm fronds or something like that, and more like a camping mattress or something like that. But actually I was really, impressed. That's a very modern looking bed for 1800 years ago. But that's found on the wall of the church. They had a whole bunch of gospel stories painted on the walls of that church from a couple hundred years after Jesus in modern day Syria. And a lot of those pictures are now, I think they're situated in Yale University in America. But you can look them up. There's a whole bunch up on the internet. Thanks. So here we have this story of Jesus turning up and healing this guy. And I love the way he calls him Sir. You know why he calls him Sir? Because he has no idea who this guy is. He's like, what? Who? What? And his healing is a sign and a wonder. This guy is like, what's happening to me? And who are you? This is an amazing situation. And it's for the glory of God. And glory is a key theme in the Gospel of John. I want to credit a lot of my thoughts I'm going to share with you. I want to credit Richard Baucom, his book, Gospel of Glory. Great title. I read a lot of Richard Baucom when I wrote my thesis a couple of years ago. And in terms of early church and the Gospels, he's a fantastic guy to read. So glory, the theme of glory, for the glory of God. It's a big theme in John. We have John 1:14. It says, "The Word became flesh." John 1:14. "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling amongst us. We have seen his glory." This is the author of the Gospel of John talking about him and his associates. "We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. So the concept of glory is very important in the Gospel of John. We heard from Pastor Aaron a couple weeks ago about turning the water into wine, John 2. It says there in John 2:11, what Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory and his disciples believed in him. He revealed his glory. So these signs that we're studying at the moment, that we're looking at, are about the revelation of glory. You got so many stories where people are like, who was that guy? And what just happened? And they're trying to get their heads around what on earth is going on in Jerusalem these days. I'm just paraphrasing, of course. I don't know how they express themselves. But I want to spend some time setting the scene, the context, helping us to understand. Have you ever wondered, well, what does glory mean? For the glory of God, what? If you're like me, you stop and you think, well, hang on, what is that word? Glory. I mean, it sounds glorious, but what does it mean? That was a weak joke, I know. All the ones I make up on the moment are usually like that. You don't need to give me a polite laugh, it's all right. So if we're going to do some analysis on this word glory, we've got to start with the Hebrew Bible. We've got to start with the word kavod. And this is like the core meaning of this word, which we translate as glory in the Hebrew Bible. It comes from the root word, not that it matters that much, but the kaved, which means to be heavy. And we see that there's three possible meanings, or there's three different ways of understanding the word kavod from this root meaning. The first means wealth, power, importance. So if you think of to be heavy, to be important, to be substantial, I guess. And so the first category of meaning of kavod is wealth, power, importance. And because prestige was associated with these things, and honor was given to people who were important and wealthy, the second category came up of honor, prestige, and good reputation. So there's two categories. And then leading on from that, and it seems quite logical, a third category of meaning for kavod. In the ancient world, honor and prestige often had visible manifestation. If you were important and wealthy and influential, you would wear clothing, jewelry, and be generally magnificent. So the third category of the meaning is visible splendor. So you see that? We're going from wealth, power, importance, developing the idea of honor and prestige, and then the third one, visible splendor. And this is what God has for us when we see his glory. Glory in this sense is always something visible. So the Greeks, you know, they had to have their way as the dominant culture. And when they when Greek-speaking people translated the Hebrew Bible, they chose a word to represent glory, to represent kavod, and they chose the word doxa. And this usually means to have an opinion, but it also means to have a reputation or honor. So there's a small overlap in the meaning between the Hebrew and the Greek, but it's not that much. It would seem that the writers of the Greek Hebrew Bible sort of lent into the Hebrew meaning more than the Greek meaning of the word. But, you know, it's tough to do translation work. At the end of the day, you got to pick something. You got to look at the language you've got. You know what I mean? You got to look at the language available, and you got to pick some word to make sense. So they pick the word doxa. So the New Testament follows this usage that the Greek Hebrew Bible did. And so doxa in the New Testament, this word we translate glory, has two different categories. It has the category of honor and reputation, and also the category similarly of visible splendor. So we see in the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament, in Israel's history, God's glory is only ever partially revealed. You're all familiar with the story in Exodus 33. Exodus 33, 18 to 20. Moses says to God, you're all familiar with this one, "Now show me your glory." And the Lord said, "I will cause all of my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence." But he said, "You cannot see my face, for no one can see me and live." So here's this idea of sort of partial hiddenness for our own benefit, if you like. Going on in Exodus 33 at verse 21, "Then the Lord said, 'There is a place near me where you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft in the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen.'" I imagine Moses was feeling a little nervous at this point, but also excited. Excited, nervous. Exodus 34, 6. This is the moment. God passed in front of Moses. And this is so important. God proclaimed, "The Lord, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness." There it is, God's glory. So God's glory is the radiance of his character, of his goodness, of who we see, of who he truly is. And this is what the face of God would reveal if Moses could see it. So God had to give him a verbal summary of what was going on in many ways. A person's identity is made visible in the person's face. Moses cannot see, but he does hear. So if kavod or doxa speaks of honor or visual splendor, how can we imagine what's going on? And so I do require you to engage with your imagination a little bit here. But imagine, have you seen, some of you may not have because you're just totally not interested, but sometimes like royal families, I know in England, with special occasions, they will come out on a balcony for the general people to view them, right? It's a little weird in that sort of sense, but it's like, in 5 minutes, you'll be able to view the royal family. The viewing will happen soon. And crowds gather. And then the royal family come out. And you, the ordinary people, are allowed to view their glory. You imagine an ancient culture where most people are like subsistence farmers, right? Or artisans or tradesmen or something like that. No money, basically dressed in very ordinary clothing. Can you imagine the moment that their royal family came out, bejeweled in gold and precious stones, incredible linens and things like that? The glory you behold. I mean, for an ordinary sort of peasant who had nothing, can you imagine? It would seem a little glorious, wouldn't it? That moment where they came out in all their regalia. And we have this story where our king, King of Kings, says to Moses, "I'm going to let you partially behold me, my visual splendor." And I was so touched when I was reading this. It was like, so, what did he look like? What is he all about? What struck you? "The Lord, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, patient, abounding in love, faithfulness, trustworthiness." This is how God chose to describe to Moses the magnificence of his splendor and glory. This is what our King looks like. This is what he is about. My friend, if you ever have a moment, if you ever were so blessed to be able to behold our King, this is what you would come away with. That's so beautiful. That's so incredible. This is what our King looks like. This is the visual splendor of our King, and this is his glory. That he is compassionate, that he is grace-filled, that he has this incredible beneficence about him, that he pours out. James says, every good and perfect gift comes flowing down from the Father above. He is gracious and compassionate. He is full of glory. It's interesting that that verse says, every good and perfect gift, because there's a flow of beneficence flowing down from him. He is gifting. He is giving. I just think, you know, to the humble, he gives strength. He gives courage. To the hungry, he gives the bread of heaven. He pours out his goodness. He fills you. It's just in his nature. It's in his glory to give you stuff, to pour out over you and to love on you and to have compassion on you and to be patient with you and to be faithful and full of trust. He's trustworthy and faithful and true. And it's like, wow, this is the glory. Are you getting the picture now that this is the glory of God? This is who he is. This is his magnificent splendor. If you were so lucky to be able to just view him for a moment like Moses, you would see. Though hidden, because God said, if you saw my face, you would be instantly vaporized. Because he is holy and pure. And unrighteousness cannot stand in his presence. So God says, you can see a little bit. There might be some long-term health consequences, I don't know. But, you know, God's like, this is a safe dose for now. And some of you might think, well, that's cruel. No, that's holiness. That's the purity and holiness of God. That if God actually revealed himself fully, everything that is corrupt gets vaporized. But he is a God of love, and he has a plan for humanity that we are all aware of. I love this question that Richard Borkman poses. He goes, but since no one can see the face of God and live, why was the incarnation, Jesus, not fatal to those who saw him? That's a good question. If Jesus really was God, how come people weren't just dying everywhere he walked? I think that's really interesting to think about. Some of you are looking at me like, you're a bit of a strange person. You spend time thinking about things like this. I can't help it. It's the way I was built. I just think about stuff like this. So does Richard Borkman, so that encourages me. The answer to that question is that God manifested himself in something not divine. His covering was his flesh, human life. He came as a human being. That's our way of being sort of hidden in the rock, so to speak. The glory that was hidden in the Hebrew Bible is now concealed in flesh. Now, Isaiah expected this time. In Isaiah 40, verse 5, it says, the glory of the Lord will appear, and all flesh will see the salvation of God. All flesh will see the glory when it is revealed in flesh. I remind you again of John 1:14. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling. He tabernacled, or the Greek word there is, he tented amongst us. I find that fascinating because you know what a lot of tents were made of? Animal skin. So God wrapped himself in skin and lived amongst us. He tabernacled amongst us. He tempted amongst us. He put on flesh so that he could be amongst us. And you know, when he said, we have seen his glory, he's not talking about Christians in general. In this specific instance, he's talking about the eyewitnesses who saw Jesus in the flesh with their physical eyes. So John's statement there, full of grace and truth, is a Greek equivalent to the phrase abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness that we read in Exodus 34. So John is borrowing that language, that Moses encounter language. He's borrowing that same language when he's talking about the Son becoming flesh and tenting amongst us. The glory is the radiance of the character of God, the grace and truth about which Moses heard, but which the disciples of Jesus had seen in his human person and self. So it brings us on to these signs, the signs of God, the signs in the Gospel of John. The most obvious way in which the glory of God is revealed in Jesus' ministry is in the miracles for which John uses the term signs. So the water into wine, we've already talked about that. It says in John 2:11 that it revealed his glory. And as a consequence, his disciples believed in him. The sixth sign that we haven't done yet, so, you know, I'm sort of getting a bit ahead of myself. The raising of Lazarus in John 11:40 reveals the glory of God and is said to be for God's glory so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. So all of the signs reveal the glory of God, which is also Jesus' own glory, the divine glory revealed in him. So Jesus is turning up, God in flesh. And people don't understand. And the signs are causing people to wonder, who is this man? What is going on? It's important to read in Isaiah 53:2. Isaiah 53:2, about how Jesus was to manifest. It says, he grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. So the signs are important because Jesus was not self-evidently the revelation of the glory of God. The glory of God was hidden in human flesh. The signs that we've been studying are about the revelation to the people around him and to us that this man was more than a man, that he was the revelation of the glory of God. And we, like Moses, got to see him. We saw his glory. And don't forget what we've just talked about. What is his glory? The Lord, gracious and compassionate, full of love, patience, trustworthy, faithful. We have seen the glory of God. So Jesus revealed the glory of God in the flesh. And as a result, people who encountered him had all sorts of opinions about him. But it wasn't self-evident. It required curiosity. It required stickability, to stick with the situation, to ask questions, to probe. And some people went away not understanding. Even people who got healed walked away not understanding. They couldn't understand who he was. The signs caused people to wonder whether they are encountering something more than just human flesh. Now each sign means something specific. Each of them says something about Jesus and the eternal life that he is coming to give. And like Jesus himself, these signs are visible. And that they are visible is absolutely essential because they are our means of seeing the glory of God. As visible events that exceed the flesh is capable of, they signal the presence of God's glory. So eternal life in John is so much more than the issues of earthly mortal life, but it is certainly nothing less than that. So the fact that people get healed, the fact that they are provided for with bread and wine and all this stuff is about eternity, but eternity is inclusive of our physicality in that sense. I think we forget that. I think we forget that God's plans for eternity are very fleshly. In the sense, new heaven and new earth. Like you are not destined to spend eternity floating in heaven as a disembodied spirit. You know that's not Christian doctrine, right? New heaven, new earth, physical bodies. Yes, they are not bodies of the flesh that we have now. They are glorified bodies, but Jesus showed us that they are physical bodies. And this is a very physical realm. And everything about Hebrew Jewish culture, the traditions, the history, the whole idea, the history behind resurrection is always very physical. It was later in the church that Platonic ideas, that's his ideas from Plato, came in to influence the church and started to talk to us about being spirits in heaven and being released from this mortal earth so we can be free, truly free in the cosmos. That's not Christian doctrine. Christian doctrine is about resurrection, a new heaven and a new earth and bodies of spiritual matter, as Paul discusses in 1 Corinthians 15. Don't have time to go into all of that today. But I think when we look at the signs, we need to realize that physical healings, whilst beneficial to the person who receives it today, also speak of eternity. They speak of an eternity where there is no more sickness, where there is no more disease, where there is no more disfiguring and corruption in our bodies. It speaks to an eternity of perfection. So by eternity does surpass our human existence, our physical existence, but it does not leave it behind, if you get what I mean. And that is why it is essential that the risen Jesus is still Jesus in his full bodily reality. He takes his fleshly reality up to a new form of life beyond the reach of death. And that's why I tell people it's very important that there is a man in heaven right now. Jesus didn't ascend as a spirit or as some sort of apparition. He ascended to heaven as a fleshly person. And that's why it's so important, you know, that the disciples sort of touch him and feel him. That's reminding us that it's not something else, that it is this very fleshly thing. And that's why signs and wonders point to eternity. I think it's important to realize that or to be reminded of that. So when Jesus gives the paralyzed man bodily health and strength, you know, the man sitting by the pool, along with the enhancements of his life that this brings, it is not just a sign of something purely spiritual, but it's something different. It's the renewal of the whole life through participation in the divine life. So Jesus says to him, do you want to get well? Do you want to be well? He's inviting him into eternity in that sense. It's a picture of the glory of God. It's God's compassion. You know, the verse that says Jesus had compassion and healed the sick. It's his nature. It's his glory on display. Jesus immediately commands the man to raise up, take up his pallet or his bed and walk. Immediately he does so. The cure is instant and complete. Commentators debate on whether there was a faith response involved. Was he healed and then stood up? Or was he healed as he stood up? I just think the fact that he cooperated with this guy that he didn't know, like he obviously responded in some way. I love the way he calls him sir. He's like, who is this man? And I think that's really important in the Gospel of John. You got all these people asking, who is this man? And it's like the author of the gospel is saying to you, who do you think this man is? You weren't there, but you read the stories. You enter into them. They're written for your benefit so that you can look at them and you can ask the same questions. Who is this man? What is he about? What is so special? What is he releasing? That's why at the beginning there, John is connecting this with Moses' experience. Do you understand the importance of that? His glory is being revealed, the glory of God. So many signs in John, so many things pointing to the beauty of God, pointing to his plans for humanity. One thing that stood out to me is that we are called to participate. Jesus doesn't just walk around Jerusalem or Judea snapping his fingers and things start happening. I don't know if you've noticed, but he's engaging with people. Even the water with the wine. His mother says to the people, do whatever he says to do. And I think that is crucial for us too, because we want to see the glory of God revealed, don't we? And so God is saying to us, do what I ask you to do. You might be like the servants in that wedding feast. You don't really know what you're doing, but you suddenly get in. You get a sense that you're supposed to do something. And in your obedience, the glory of God is revealed. In John 4, we had this last week, the Kristen spoke about. The royal official said, sir, come down before my child dies. Go, Jesus replied, your son will live. The man took Jesus at his word and departed. It required something of him in obedience and in response. And in his obedient response, the glory of God was revealed. In John 5 that we've just been reading today, Jesus said to him, get up, pack up your mat and walk. At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. You know, I believe he could have refused to get up, even if he was healed. I've seen people healed and almost refuse to acknowledge it. It took something for him to stand up. Can you imagine if you'd been paralyzed, unable to walk for 38 years, and someone said, get up? Like, he may have felt something happening in his body, but I bet there was a mental battle to respond. Don't forget, he had no idea who this guy was. He was just like, what's going on? It's not just another ordinary Tuesday. Something's going on. This guy has just walked in, come up to me and said, you, do you want to be well? And he's like, yeah, there's issues with my disability and getting into the water. And Jesus says, just get up. Wow. Some response needed. So the thing that came to me was, in all these situations, God in humanity, God in the flesh, engaged people, engaged the flesh. He's always engaging with us. Jesus, you know, go and get the boys loaves and fishes. Jesus could have just gone, watch this, boys, lunch. Have you ever noticed that he didn't do that? But he said, go and get what you have and bring it to me. Okay, now start to distribute it. He wants you involved in the release of his glory. And I just want to encourage you in this next week or so to be meditating on Moses' experience and what it meant for Moses to see the glory of God. I don't know, I have just enjoyed meditating on that moment and God saying, I'm going to tell you what you can't see, because if you saw it, your eyes would cease to exist. Because God is holy and pure. But God had a plan for humanity, because he doesn't want everyone vaporized. He wants life to flow. He wants hope to flow. He wants healing to flow. He wants humanity to be fully alive and fully redeemed and fully restored, doesn't he? He has a plan, and his plan was to send of himself in the form of flesh. And that took some discernment for people to understand what was going on. But the writer of this gospel keeps saying the glory of God was revealed. And you know, especially as charismatic Pentecostals, we can focus so much on the power, ministry, the bam, and it was done. But we forget that, what about Jesus the man? What about the vibe of Jesus? What about being around him? What was that like? What was it like to be in his presence? What was it like to be healed by him? What was it like to be with him afterwards? What was it like to be in the presence of the glory of God? I don't know about you, but I was just super encouraged by reading this. Number one, I've been wondering about this idea of what the glory is. And it's been super satisfying for me this week to spend time understanding, a better understanding of what the glory of God is. It's about who He is and wants to do and wants for us. Because He is gracious. He has beneficence. I love that word. It just sounds so good. It means that we get to benefit from being around Him. That's what it means to be gracious. If you're with someone who's gracious, your life is enriched by just being around them. You are changed by being with someone who is gracious, because they are pouring out into your life and you would just feel richer every moment you're with someone who is gracious. It's pouring out. This is the grace of God. Every good and perfect gift flowing down from the Father of lights. This is the goodness of God. This is the grace of God. So to be around a gracious God is to be constantly enriched and better for the moment. Every moment spent in His presence, we just are a better person. We are enriched. We are freed. We are enlivened. It's just more and more beauty. And I believe that the message from God to us through this story and through all these signs in John is that, will you come and do stuff with me? Will you come? A little later in that chapter, Jesus says, I only do what I see the Father doing. And I thought that was really interesting coming off of that story where there's all these disabled people and He walks up to one man and says, you today, right now, you're in the presence of an incredibly gracious God. And things are going to start happening to you as you spend time with me. They're going to change your life. Not just your physical body, but your eternal perspective as well, your eternal life as well. Things are going to start happening to you. The amazing thing about God's grace and His patience is you're free to reject it. You're free to turn around and go, no thanks. And doesn't stop Him pouring it out. It's beautiful, isn't it? Anyway, I want to encourage you today to look for opportunities to be aware of what the King of Grace is doing, what the God of goodness and patience is doing around you. You might be the servant in the wedding feast pouring water into things. You might be like the disciples gathering the loaves and fishes. Who knows what God is asking you to do, but He's asking you, inviting you, to partner with Him to release the glory of God to the world around you. Amen.